Welcome to The Connection, John. I thoroughly enjoyed your book, and I just want to sort of introduce who you are and what this book is. I read a lot of books, and they're usually language helps. They're commentary types. They're history books for Bible teaching. But I love it when I can take a journey in a book that captivates me, which is hard to do in a book form. I have like a short attention span. But you wrote a book called Wayward Son, and that's the name of it, right?
That's correct.
And what I was told about it by a board member said, you got to get this book. So I downloaded it on my iPad and I started reading it, and I could not put this book down. Now, you wrote this book, but you had help doing it, right?
Well, I should probably portray myself as one of the helpers.
Okay.
We have a principal author here, a dear friend by the name of Tom Pollock, and another close friend, Jim Alves, and myself are Tom's co-authors in the project.
Mm. Now, I have written books, about 20 of them. How do you write a book with three people?
We get asked that question probably more than any other skip, and I think for a lot of people it seems to be kind of mystifying that three people can collaborate on a novel. From our experience, what I would say is this: it's probably easier to write something like this with three folks than it would have been with, say, two, and possibly even than one, because our skills in this, I think, were real complementary. But many, many times throughout the process, we encounter differences of opinion. And with three people, it's much, much easier to resolve those, I think, than it would be if you just had two collaborators and they were both dug in on their positions. You know, with three, there's just sort of a natural swing vote that allows for an easier resolution, I think. More broadly, I think in this particular instance, we just had some skill sets that really complemented one another, and so it was actually once we got our groove, and I won't represent it was the easiest thing to do at first, but once we kind of got our groove on, it was a real joy.
So I want to sort of let our audience know what we're talking about. We're talking about a book that's a novel, and if you haven't read it yet, it's called Wayward Son. I got the book. A couple of my staff members got the book. I wanted to get their take on it. And it's an adventure story, but it has a profound spiritual message behind it. I don't want to give the book away, but as I read it, it revolves around two storylines. One is the story of Cain, the biblical Cain, and the other is a modern tale of a major archaeological discovery. Did I kind of set that up right, John?
Yep. There's no real big spoilers there yet.
Okay. Okay. Good.
I'll give a few things away as we talk about it.
Well, how did the idea for this kind of a book even come about?
Well, it's interesting. Tom, being the principal author, the basic premise for the novel was his original idea. And as he tells it, about four and a half years ago, he found himself alone in a hotel room in Europe with nothing to read. And thankfully, there by the bedstand was the ubiquitous Gideon's Bible. And he just picked it up and began at the beginning. And as he went along, he likes to say how he was really struck by seeing the lifespan that's described in Genesis of some of the major actors, Adam living for 900 years, Methuselah for 960, Noah living, you know, many, many hundreds of years. And Tom was really struck by that. But in particular, he noted as he read through the story about Cain and Abel and whatever became of Cain that Cain's lifespan was not mentioned, and nor did it really speak of Cain's ultimate fate, other than just kind of having to be a homeless vagabond and wander off to the land of Nod. So he started scratching his head a little bit about that, and he was also quite intrigued by the part of the interview with God between God and Cain, where Cain was concerned that people would find him and kill him, and God put some sort of mark upon Cain to warn people off, ostensibly. And Tom was very curious about what that mark could be. So one day he came to me. We were sharing an office at the time, and he started telling me about his idea. And he asked me, because he knew that I had a fair bit of familiarity with the Bible, whether or not the Bible ever really did record Cain's death, and he shared that it did not. And then he asked me, what about this mark that God put on Cain? Was it some sort of physical sign, or kind of like, as he put it, he was thinking that it might be kind of like that big red blotch on Gorbachev's head or something. And I didn't have a ready answer to that, but I dug through some commentaries and found that there really wasn't any general agreement whether it was a physical mark or some other type of sign. And so when I shared that information with Tom, he said, well, that's cool. I have this crazy idea. I want you to listen. And he said, what if the mark was more than just a warning, but actually allowed Cain to continue to live on and on and on?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, I don't think the Bible remotely suggests that, but it's an interesting idea. Where are you going with this? And he said, well, picture it. The first human being ever born, living on throughout history, would accumulate all kinds of knowledge, all kinds of skill, and so on, and we could take him through all of the major ancient empires of history, and he could have some very fun and interesting exploits.
Hmm.
And I thought, wow, that is quite an idea. And so he drew Jim into the discussion, and we started brainstorming about where this story could ultimately go. And indeed, we found an opportunity, first of all, to write imaginatively about what that land of Nod or later Enoch would be like. But then we took Cain to ancient Egypt. We took him to ancient Greece. We took him to Persia and Babylon around the time of Artaxerxes.
Mm-hmm.
We even took him to China. He traveled the Silk Road and made it all the way to China before ultimately settling in the Mediterranean region around the first century A.D. And I feel compelled to give this away. Living where he did and in the time that he did, he had three opportunities to meet with a particular carpenter from Nazareth. And you know how the story worked out, but that may suggest to some of your audience kind of what this story is really all about.
Yeah. And I want to just, again, underscore to our listeners, this is a novel. We're not suggesting that it is biblical, but it does have a historical and biblical setting. And I found it fascinating the way you wove all the stories together. What I particularly loved, John, was the ability to kind of brush up on my history, because you take the reader through details of history, biblical stories, archaeology. And as I was going through that, kind of bouncing back from a modern to an ancient world, I was thinking the kind of research that you, your team, must have had to amass to put together a story like that.
Well, that was a big, big part of it. And here again, I have to credit Tom, first of all, for being, among the three of us, the real history buff. So he brought a pretty high degree of familiarity with some of these ancient empires and so on. But naturally, the minute we start going into particular times and places and details, all three of us definitely had to dig in and do a lot of extra research to try to make the portrayal as realistic as we could. For me, I have to tell you, it was just a real eye-opener. My background is much more in finance and political science, but more in the modern era. So this was a tremendous fun for me just to have my eyes open to some periods and stories of history that I wasn't intensely familiar with, but learned a great deal as we went along.
Well, I remember reading this and sympathizing with this character and wondering how he's going to get out of this dilemma, like with the Pharaoh. And all these interesting stories, I couldn't wait to go home in the evening and get into that book just to find out what's next. And as I recall, you said that your original plan for the book was a movie script. Tell us about that and what made you guys decide to do it in book form.
Well, Tom had been really fresh off the heels of a project that he was fortunate enough to have done with a good friend of his who recently passed on by the name of Roy Disney. And Tom had met Roy through a mutual interest in sailing, and he gave Roy an idea for sort of a documentary movie that Roy ultimately decided to make. It was called Morning Light, and it profiled the exploits of young college-age sailors who entered and dueled in the Trans-Pacific race from Los Angeles down to Hawaii. It was a wonderful film, and he was pretty jacked up on that and thought that this particular story idea that he had could also become a movie. He was also inspired by The Passion of the Christ, having seen that and seen what sort of acclaim and really ultimate success the movie had. It was his sense that, you know, Christian audiences don't really receive a lot of good quality stuff from Hollywood. In fact, all audiences receive quite a lot of stuff that you know, none of us can speak too fondly about. And so when he shared with Jim and myself this premise, we thought we probably were going to try to detail out a movie line. But I must say that it was not part of the original premise to take Kane all the way to the time of first century A.D., and once that became part of our brainstorm for this novel, and we realized that we had the opportunity to kind of place the gospel message squarely within this novel, it occurred to us that we could write a screenplay. Hollywood could pick it up, but if they made the movie out of it, it could deviate so far from a story that became rather important to us that, you know, we potentially wouldn't even recognize it when it hit the screen. And so as we discussed that, we thought, you know, it might make sense to just hunker down and write this as a novel. And if we're fortunate enough to have the novel become widely known, then if we're even more fortunate to ever have a movie made out of it, there's probably a better chance that what appears on the screen is more faithful to our story and the message within it. So that's kind of how it changed course, and why we have a 507-page epic novel instead of a screenplay.
You mentioned that you had a background in finance and political science. With your backgrounds, all three of you, did you take different parts? Like, would one do research, and would you then converse sort of through the plan periodically?
Well, I would say the process worked sort of like this. The three of us would be together for days and weeks on end, just sort of brainstorming together about what we thought the story should be. And then when we would settle on particular places and details and elements of history or elements of the Bible that intersected with some of that history, if it had to do with just sort of history, Tom would kind of spearhead doing a lot of the research on that. And from that research, he would produce an outline. And from that outline, typically one of the three of us would then say, okay, it's time to actually get the prose down on the page. Personally, I had done a fair bit of writing in my investment career, but it was a lot more dry than this. I published a variety of articles in financial journals and written contributed chapters to textbooks and so on. So I had some facility with the written word, but really no experience prior to this with this sort of creative writing process. So what we found was whoever had the thickest skin, which I think oftentimes turned out to be me, would be the first one to produce a chapter or a series of chapters, and then you'd have to put up with the savagery of the editing process from my two partners. You know, it worked out well in the end, because we came up with a story that was compelling enough to us to kind of keep us completely stimulated throughout the process.
Do you have a favorite part of the book, John?
Well, I do. And my favorite part is when we take Kane to China and he has an opportunity to interact with the first emperor of China.
Yes.
And what's fun about it, first of all, was what was a tremendous discovery. I was relatively unfamiliar with this period of history. Tom had some familiarity, but as we looked into it, what we found was the first emperor had accomplished an unbelievable amount of stuff. And for any of the listeners who are familiar with the army of terracotta soldiers that was discovered in China,
right,
he did things on such a vast scale that it almost defies imagination.
Hmm.
But what was even more fun was it turns out that the first emperor, a fellow by the name of I hope my pronunciation isn't too awful here, Qin Shi Huangdi.
Wow, that's really good.
He was actually on a personal quest for immortality. And so it created a really fun irony where here's a guy who actually, at least in our story, is immortal, rubbing shoulders with a guy who's trying to become immortal.
Mm-hmm.
And by this time, Kane's been alive for literally thousands and thousands and thousands of years. He's had so many ups and downs, and he's actually rather tired of the whole game. And so he's encountering this first emperor, and they become fellow travelers in some interesting ups and downs and antics and so on, and actually has an opportunity to attempt to share with the emperor the message that, hey, a really long lifespan isn't all it's cracked up to be.
Yeah.
And the way that scene gets resolved is both ironic and actually, in my humble opinion, rather humorous.
Yeah, I found it interesting the way you made what most people would call a blessing out to be really the mark, the curse. And you have Kane saying basically, been there, done that. And when the emperor finally discovers that Cain heals so quickly and how that dawns on him before his death, the way that was written was riveting.
We had an awful lot of fun with many parts of the book, and that in particular was a lot of fun to write.
John, as you guys worked through this process, you, Tom, and Jim, how did this impact you spiritually, your walk with the Lord?
I came into this with probably enough knowledge of the Bible to help out my two partners, whose exposure to Scripture was rather more limited. For me, it was an opportunity to just discover the idea of how God can just bless something. And I, without going into too many specific examples, I can just tell you that there were numerous encounters where we'd be stuck on something, and then all of a sudden the Lord would seem to just provide a resource from out of the blue that would really help us with the process. And that pertains not only to the writing of the book, but also because we are self-publishing this book. It also pertains to resources that were provided to help get us through the actual process of producing a book. And so for me, it was just a wonderful affirmation of how if you're willing to yield and you're willing to wait on the Lord will provide.
Right.
I think for Tom and Jim, their walk has been impacted probably more than anything with a real appreciation for the Bible, a greater understanding of what it's really all about, and just deeper familiarity with Scripture, and a much deeper affinity for God's Word. So it's been a wonderful spiritual journey for the three of us, and that whole process continues as we're out talking about the book and trying to get it positioned well in the marketplace.
John, what's your hope for this book? What kind of an impact do you want it to have?
Well, we think of this book as, first of all, a nice quality addition to the body of entertaining things with a Christian message for a Christian audience. But I think more important than that, we're telling a story about a guy who has experienced really all that the world has to offer. I mean, he attains in various places and times vast power, vast wealth, acquires tremendous knowledge as he lives on and on. He has grand achievements. He has relationships. He has what, you know, many people in this day and age seem to think really is the Holy Grail, and that's longevity beyond imagination. And throughout all those worldly gains and all those worldly pursuits, you know, he's fundamentally empty. And, you know, all that the world has to offer is nothing compared to what God has to offer.
Mm-hmm.
And so we hope that this is something that believers who encounter the book will not only be entertained and inspired by, but also can hand to somebody who's a seeker, somebody who's a non-believer or even a skeptic, and have that message sort of percolate within the hearts of people to really just come to know that all these worldly endeavors, while they can be blessings, can also just really take you away from what the most important thing is, and that is a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. And
Excellent.
So if this book turns out to be successful, we hope that is so, because the Lord has used it to draw many more people unto himself.
Beautiful. John, as I recall, there's a surprise ending. I don't want to give that away or even get into it, but it read to me like you were setting up for a sequel. Am I right?
You are right. One of the things we haven't really touched upon, we've really talked about the main storyline here, and that is the story of Cain and our sort of reimagining of what might have happened to him. But this very story in our novel is discovered by a present-day archaeologist, a woman by the name of Amanda James. And Amanda doesn't have a real strong religious background as a character, but she finds herself caught up in a real dilemma once she has been essentially given this story, which is the entire knowledge of whatever happened to Cain's life. We have within this book, we wrestled a little bit with this and decided to put not only Cain and God the Father and Jesus into the novel, but we also have a fairly prominent role for the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And so not only does the enemy kind of hound Cain throughout his life, he is also present in the modern day, attempting to orchestrate things so that this discovery about Cain's life and ultimate fate can be suppressed. But now that the knowledge has been given to Amanda, towards the end of the book, she finds herself, I should say, in a bit of hot water. And we don't really, we do end the book a little bit on a cliffhanger in that regard, so that the reader would probably want to know, okay, Amanda, now that you know all this, now what?
Yes.
And book two in our series will have a lot more to do with what Amanda must confront now that she's been given all of this sizzling kind of information about Cain.
Well, I can't wait till that comes out. Any idea when?
Oh, hopefully within the next 18 to 24 months. We would not characterize ourselves as James Patterson or Tom Clancy, that, you know, are old hands at this, and we can just crank them out.
Yeah,
we took a lot of time and care and effort with this project, and we know that book two, if it's going to be any good, will probably require a lot of time and care as well.
Mm-hmm.
But also, right now, our main focus is on more promoting the novel the Wayward Son novel, and once we think that's got some sufficient traction, I think we're going to probably go back to ground and get started in earnest on the sequel.
Well, we wish you many blessings on that. I just want to quickly segue here at the end. You head up a couple of nonprofit organizations, I understand, the 1 Corinthians 13, 13 Foundation, as well as the Southern California Children's Chorus. What are those? Tell us about those.
Well, the 1 Corinthians 13, 13 Foundation is just the name that that I came up with for a family foundation that we started. And as you know, that particular verse says, I think in King James, that now these three things abide, faith, hope, and charity, but the greatest of these is charity. And that kind of jumped out at me as a good name for a charitable foundation. The foundation is basically something where, having attained some fruits of my labor back in the investment management business, I try to direct grant activities towards a variety of different causes. My principal concern is global evangelism, and so that's probably it receives at least a plurality of the foundation's grants, but also the arts. And that kind of takes me to the Southern California Children's Chorus. My interest in the arts was not something that I consider native to my psyche, but my wife, Lori, is a very accomplished professional musician, keyboardist, organist, harpsichordist. In fact, that's how we met. But she's also got extraordinary gifts in working with children. And so about 16 years ago, she founded the Southern California Children's Chorus, which has grown to serve about 320 to 350 kids at a time from all over Orange County, California. And I'm president of the board there, so she runs the musical side, and I help her run the business side. And it's been a tremendous blessing seeing so many young people positively impacted, not only by music, but also by Lori and the other faculty members' amazing gifts at working with them. In fact, some of your listeners, if they paid any attention to the Academy Awards show in February, would have heard members of the Southern California Children's Chorus. It was a real honor that they were chosen to sing during that portion of the Academy Awards where they have the pictures of those members of the Screen Actors Guild who had passed away during the prior year. And they've gone all over the world. They've sung at Carnegie Hall. They've sung in the Sydney Opera House and so on. And it's just a wonderful, wonderful group. I happen to think they can sing on par with the Vienna Boys Choir, but I'm a little biased.
Beautiful. We've been talking with John Loftus. John, great having you with us today. Thank you so much.
Well, Skip, it's a real honor to speak with you. So glad you enjoyed the book. And if any of your listeners also have the opportunity to read it, we'd love to hear their feedback.
Thank you, John. God bless.
God bless you, too.